The Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN, produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. Tom Gimbel, regular guest, is the founder and CEO of LaSalle Network. Tom, I had to laugh when I saw one of the stories you thought we should talk about, which is headlined in the Wall Street Journal, "A New Quest to Make Offices Less Awful." Hooray! Hooray! Well, let's do that then, shall we?
Well, it's funny because offices went to trying to be cool to compete for people, yeah. Right? Farm-to-table restaurants, and we're going to have foosball tables and kegs and all that stuff. And now they're saying we need to do it to make it more appealing than people's homes. And I'm not sure that's the right answer either.
Oh, really? So, yeah, do the first part, though. What are some of the general strategies out there to... Boy, this is just, it's still an upside-down world if companies have to struggle to find employees and then beg them to come to work, you know, at the place of employment. Talk about some of the strategies then they're using to entice people back in.
Yeah, so they're making it more living room. And they're almost doing what Starbucks was originally did with the coffee shop cafes, right, is create more of a couches and lounge chair environment, have TVs. Salesforce is creating more bigger eating areas, kitchens, dining rooms, things like that, which is ironic when the companies that say we want everybody to work from home because we're appealing to the employees, but then we're going to make our offices better so you'll want to come here, which is really just saying we really want you here, but we're afraid to tell you that because you'll quit. So we're going to try and lure you back by making it better than your house, which is crazy. The comfort level of being at home is never going to equal what it is in the house. You've got to give people a reason of what they're going to achieve and accomplish to get people to want to come back into the office.
Yeah, so now we're getting to the second part. How do you do that? What does that mean?
Well, that comes into it starts at the top with leadership from the C-suite, but it really becomes in how you train your managers to lead and manage people. And what people work for a variety of reasons, first and foremost, to put a roof over their heads and to provide for themselves and their families. But then you get into what makes people like their jobs aside from where you are or who you do it with. And that is a sense of accomplishment, what you achieve. And that comes through challenging projects, through managing people to get them better at their skill set so they can get promoted. And it can be the coolest office in the world with all the fringe benefits. But if you're not learning new skills, if you're not accomplishing things, and if you're not getting promoted, then you're going to say, why am I here? And sometimes it just takes a little bit longer for people to realize that. But the people who come in just because the office is cool, those may not be your best employees.
Sounds a little like they're trying that fear of missing out concept where if you find out on Fridays and Mondays even that they have free lunch coupons and they're having a fun time there at work and there I am next to the laundry room toiling away, maybe I ought to have more fun and go to work. I hear what you're saying, though, about what truly motivates people, and a cool workspace does not duplicate somebody's comfortable home. But I'm even wondering what's the most effective way for the company to be successful, for the company to prosper. And if devoting too much time and space to a fun work environment starts to work against you.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that, John. And so what is the reason that a company exists? And if you go and do a textbook class from any MBA program, it's to provide profitable return to its shareholders, right? That's why companies exist. Now, you can say that on a parallel path, we want to do good for the community and we want to do right by our employees, and all those things are really admirable and probably accurate for a lot of companies. But if you're not providing a return to shareholders at some time, there's no purpose to have the company. And so you go through that and you say to your question is what's in the best interest of the company? And the fundamental belief by the majority of CEOs that I talk to is we believe that people working together creates a more collaborative environment. And where that happens is, as you can see, and I'm sure you've probably been in a few of these meetings, John, is if you have some people up on the Zoom screen and some people in the conference room together, what you end up happening is after the call is over, the people who are in the conference room together, they continue chatting about what you were talking about in the meeting.
That's 100%.
That's the collaboration 100%. That does not exist via Zoom.
All right. Got it, Tom. Thanks for your phone call. Thanks for your wisdom. And let's visit in person sometime.
I hope to see you soon, John. Yeah. Have a great holiday if we don't talk before.
Philip Weiss joins us now, president of SciFarth at Work. Philip, thanks for getting on the phone. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for having me, John.
Happy holidays. Unless
same to you.
You're one of the people getting the pink slip in your holiday stocking. I didn't think about that. It seems like everybody's so focused on hiring and keeping employees. Are folks also getting fired this time of year?
Yeah, that is sort of the unwritten story of the end of 2021, which is we are not seeing the kind of dramatic drop in layoffs that you would expect at the end of the year, given this kind of pell-mell run to hire people. But we started tracking this, John, in late November, when we were already seeing hundreds of planned layoffs for December announced by companies, and now it's in the thousands. So even though there's a need for employees, there's companies across industries that have a variety of reasons to cut people. And interestingly, they cut them in many cases right before the end of the year, right before the holiday break.
You know, we're familiar with that. Was it Better.com that laid off about 1,000 people via Zoom? And then the CEO of that company has been put on the sidelines. I'm not sure ultimately what's going to happen to him. Do you know the answer to that? What's going to happen to that guy?
Yeah, I mean, he was instrumental in the growth of that company. And I think there's probably a lot of behind the scenes discussions as to whether the methods he used in this case and some of the ways he's allegedly managed in the past can be modified so that he can stick with it. So I bet that's one of their sort of intense areas of focus. But it's really put a spotlight, John, on both how you are best positioned to lay off people, what you should say and not say, and how you should do it. So really, the whole layoff issue became a real focus for many CEOs. And, you know, in some cases, they have probably logical reasons to lay off folks in December, even in late December. They're not going to meet final budget numbers, and it's critical that they do, and that last payroll can make the difference. Or they absolutely need to redirect resources in quarter one and feel they don't need the overhead of that number of employees that were working for the company and therefore need to make the decision right now. It still smarts and feels extremely painful and perhaps ill-timed to the employees who have paid money for holiday gifts, have thought about the end of the year as a time to focus on the positive, and now are out of a job.
So what is the best way then to do it? Let's assume that it's in the company's best interest. They don't want to do it. They've got to let people go. How do you go about doing that?
Well, you really want to, first of all, think about, John, all your reasons for doing it. Because in some cases, it's not just profit. It's about the people. For example, you know that you have some cash on hand, and you want to use that cash to give these people being laid off some severance that might not be available in the first quarter of next year. Or you're changing your benefit structure. This is very common, such that the people being let go right now can get some additional benefits while they're out of work. So look at what you are offering people and be clear about the timing is something that serves their interests as well. So that's number one. Number two, and the Better.com example you raised is really illustrative of what perhaps not to do. You want to, number one, do it as privately as possible. Try to avoid 900 people on the Zoom. In fact, one is so much better than 900. Keep it personal. Keep it private. If possible, given COVID, do it in person, because that way people feel that you are taking them seriously, you value their contributions, and you know this is going to have an impact on them.
When I heard about that Better.com story, I thought, well, maybe it's difficult to personally tell 900 people they're being let go, but I suppose 900 people have 100 managers. You know, I mean, it would seem to me like there's probably some intermediate levels of management that could have personally sent an email or placed a phone call.
That's exactly right. And, you know, a company that size with thousands of employees is going to have a fairly robust human resources structure. They likely could create a script, so to speak, language that every one of those managers, those 100 managers you identify, could have used and done so empathetically. So absolutely, that's what managers are for. They're for the tough conversations once they are properly prepped. And the other issue, of course, is you might find that you've made a decision to lay off people because you have to. You wait too long to tell them, the information gets leaked, and that affects morale across the company. So there's many reasons why you might want to be timely and do it at the end of the year if you must, but do it with the right preparation and the right messengers.
You know, as you're talking, I'm also thinking about the movie Moneyball, where Billy Bean, played by Brad Pitt, is teaching his underling how to let people go. And he says, listen, you just, and he's very intimidated by the prospect of having to do that. And he says, you sit him down, you tell him square up, you don't need to give him any extra language, that's not going to help, and make it brief and concise and thank them for their service. Those are Major League Baseball players who are going on to other Major League teams, so it's maybe not as gut-wrenching as it would be for somebody who's letting a breadwinner go and they don't have any place to go. But all of that to say, maybe keeping it as concise as possible and simple as possible is the best route.
Yeah, you couldn't have said that better. When we train companies, we'll go through sort of the script that their company uses, and we'll make every manager in the room repeat the script 5 times in a row.
Wow.
To the point that it is really imprinted, and they're not going off the outside the lines. You can see the relief in their eyes when they realize, that's all I have to say. I have to say it clearly. I have to say it like I care, and then I got to get out of the room. That formula actually works, as odd and as clinical as it sounds.
Do you recommend that the person doing that expresses remorse about having to do this?
Only, and it's a really good question, only to the extent that the person representing the company should recognize and acknowledge this is a difficult moment. This is a difficult message to deliver and to hear. Beyond that, it gets risky, because the more you open up that discussion, the more you're apt to leave those 4 corners of the script, make statements about the employee that may not be true to make them feel better about
mm-hmm.
themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Some managers get confused between a termination, a layoff, a furlough. They get tongue-tied in that moment. That's why being pretty curtailed in how far you go outside of that set language is risky.
It sounds like a scene from The Office where you got to let somebody go, and in the process of doing so, it becomes a negotiation. Now they're justifying their existence, and you say, well, yeah, you really have been doing a good job. Maybe I'll fire Bob over there, and now you're not firing anybody.
It is a comedic reference, but it is a realistic example at the same time. We have seen managers make the oddest of mistakes when they weren't really acclimated and positioned for that critical moment. In other cases, they were told to fire someone because the person was a poor performer. They didn't want to make them feel bad, so they actually called it a layoff, which means you're eliminating the position, not the person. And that came up in court years later to prove that the manager was someone they could not be trusted, was not an honest broker, because he was simply trying to make the employee feel better. So we see many variations of the theme you've just raised.
Philip Weiss is the president of Seyfarth at Work. Seyfarthatwork.com is the website, SeyFarth at Work, Seyfarthatwork.com. Nice to talk to you, Philip, as always. Thank you.
And thanks for having me, John.
Let's talk a little bit about one of the neighborhoods in Chicago. Andrew Chow is here. He's the owner of Something Sweet Donuts. And also Benji Corpus, who is the economic developer, or one of the economic development organizers for the North River Commission. So let's talk about where that is first, Benji. Where are we talking about? What neighborhood in Chicago?
Thanks for having me on, John. Yeah, we're in Albany Park. That's on the northwest side of Chicago. We'll generally call it Montrose to the Chicago River, to the north branch of the Chicago River, all the way down to Elston, more or less.
So as an economic developer, that means getting businesses into your neighborhood? Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah, 100%. Filling vacancies, encouraging patrons to visit our storefronts and to shop small here in Albany Park.
What's the challenge that way? Is it getting customers to come into the city? Is it getting businesses to invest in the neighborhood? And how do you do either?
Well, we definitely want to encourage, folks from within the city and within the region to visit Albany Park. We have a great diversity of businesses and stores that I think would be of interest to not only businesses, but patrons as well.
What's the ethnic makeup of the neighborhood?
Yeah, well, we like to say that over 40 languages are spoken in the local school system, pan-Latin America, from Mexico, El Salvador, Peru, Colombia, Middle East, Iran, Lebanese, Yemeni food, and then Chinese, Vietnamese, Filipino, Thai, and, well, everything in between.
Yeah. You know, the reason I even asked that is because of that, because I think when you think of the neighborhoods, you also think of what kind of food I'm going to get there. What's the restaurant scene? Is it, you know, the Italian neighborhood? Is it the Chinese neighborhood? That sort of thing. This is maybe pan-South American, but you said the Far East as well.
Huh? Oh, yeah, all over the place. You could basically travel around the world here in Albany Park. It's like a parts episode of Parts Unknown with Andy Bourdain.
And it also, yeah, really, it's also interesting to hear that you said 44 languages are spoken in the schools in that area, which I think is a wonderful thing on the one hand. Also a challenge, I suppose, for the schools or the businesses. Albany Park. So you said it's bound by Montrose, Elston, the North Branch of the river, right?
Yeah, because it does diverge in two different directions, both north and west.
One of the businesses that operates there, we just mentioned a moment ago, is Something Sweet Donuts. Andrew Chow is here. So that's your shop, is that right, Andrew?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for bringing some of the food by. And by the way, you guys also brought by, I don't know if you had, if this was your doing, Benji, but what was the food that I've been eating here from these restaurants?
Oh, well, Andrew's brought over quite a few number of donuts from Something Sweet, but we also brought in Nuno Kebab, some Persian kebabs located at 4701 North Kedzie Avenue, and Machete's Big Quesadillas, also on Kedzie at 4503.
Those are really good.
Yeah, they bring it.
And I don't want to pretend to be an expert on any kind of cuisine, but I do know my chocolate iced donuts. This is the best chocolate iced donut you're going to get in this city. These are really good.
Thank you.
What's your day like?
What's our day like? Oh, wow. Well, my dad bakes basically all through the night, and we make things fresh every day, so that's why it's probably the best donut you've had.
When do you start? When does your dad start baking?
Oh, he starts baking from probably 8 p.m. till the early morning, throughout the day.
When do you get in there, then?
When do I get in there? Well, I'm not involved with the baking process, but other than running like the shop. So my day kind of fluctuates between opening and closing and going over to where we bake.
So it's a family business.
Oh, yes, definitely.
You guys have one location or more than one?
Well, we've had two, but because of the pandemic, now we're down to one. But all in all, it's been really good with like the community support here in Albany Park to keep us open and keep us engaged with the community.
Where was the other one? Was it also in Albany Park?
That was in Belmont Cragin.
Yeah.
So that's like Fullerton, Laramie, Fullerton, Cicero.
I think that sometimes shops are known to the people in the neighborhood and they patronize them, A, because they really like whatever they're selling, also because they want to keep that in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
I suspect that the one that has survived had a little bit of community support that way.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it was very nice seeing like, because we live in a residential area, so with people coming in to support us and just, you know, stopping in to say hi or see how we're doing, that really helped us out a lot. And we try to give back to the community, too, with, like, fundraisers we do with schools and elementary schools to try to, you know, give that love back.
And if you, I mean, and it's in the neighborhood's best interest to patronize a business, say during a pandemic, to keep it viable, to keep those people employed, keep them paying taxes, and also to keep the shop from closing, because you'd hate to lose that. Although, if I were you guys, I would be expanding. I would be opening up more donut shops.
Yes,
is that on the horizon?
Definitely in the cards.
You sound like the business end of this operation. And so I guess that's what you're also trying to do too, Benji, is find other businesses that are seeking to expand. Are there open storefronts? I haven't been through Albany Park lately.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, part of our responsibilities is to keep track of the vacancies in our district and to fill them once we do get in touch with local entrepreneurs or other existing businesses that are looking to expand. So it's definitely part of our week-to-week responsibilities.
Are you recruiting a certain kind of business in the area? Is it retail you're looking at or restaurants? What, I don't suppose you're zoned for any kind of manufacturing or have room for anything like that. Yeah.
Definitely retail, restaurants, that sort of thing. Not too much manufacturing or industrial uses.
How hard was 2020 on Albany Park?
You know, it was it was difficult for everybody, right? But I think we build the foundation to bring resiliency through our relationships, through community building at North River Commission specifically. So that sort of thing, building that social capital, allows for businesses and for the district to really rebound and come together.
What's the outline that comes through there then? What's the nearest L stop for you guys?
Yeah, so we're at the end of the Brown Line. Kimball, Kedzie, and Rockwell are our three stations here in the neighborhood.
Yeah, and so how are businesses doing now in 2021?
You know, I think they've, after a really tough year, things are starting to perk up a little bit, I would say. You know, we're encouraging folks to shop small here in Albany Park. There are a number of different programs that we're working on. But yeah, things are looking good, and we're pretty optimistic for 2022.
Are there, economic perks? Are there things you can offer potential businesses that do want to locate in Albany Park?
Yeah, well, we also manage the special service area, and that comes with a suite of program assistance and business technical assistance that we can offer.
What's an example of that?
Yeah, the facade rebate program, for instance, it encourages business owners and property owners to beautify their storefronts through a rebate. So once the project is finished, you know, we can offer them a certain percentage back for investing not only in their business, but it also helps beautify the street, you know, having new signage, new windows, new materials.
Are there pop-ups in your neighborhood too? That seem to be pretty popular in the neighborhoods these days.
Yeah, so we received a grant from City of Chicago Business Affairs and Consumer Protection to essentially activate three vacant storefronts within our neighborhood. And we have tons of different vendors participating. And actually this Saturday, we're hosting a little holiday stroll in Albany Park at 4700 North Kimball to encourage folks to try some Andrew's donuts, drink some coffee, but also shop small and check out the neighborhood, see some of our vendors.
Come for the donuts, stay for the retail. There's your slogan for the year. Andrew Chow is the owner of Something Sweet Donuts, 4456 North Kedzie. SomethingSweetDonuts.com, and Benji Corpus is the economic development organizer for the North River Commission there in Albany Park. Continued success, guys. Thanks for coming in. And I'm really encouraged by the diversity of the neighborhood, what you guys have been saying about keeping it viable and the food. Good going.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, James.
It's 12:45 on WGN. Okay, let's continue with more business news now. Here is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Five Chicago-based nonprofits will receive $2.5 million in grants to advance work in low-income communities. Each of the organizations will receive a $500,000 grant from City Foundation. The beneficiaries include Urban Growers Collective, which operates 8 urban farms, and Elevate, which works to improve access to power, heat, and water. One of the other groups is Working Credit, which helps people establish or improve credit scores at no cost. City Foundation says the grants are part of a $25 million initiative benefiting 50 recipients in Chicago and 5 other cities. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
With the business of food, here's Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir. We hear a lot about food insecurity, which is defined by the USDA as a lack of consistent access to enough food for an active, healthy life. And that seems kind of inconceivable in this land of plenty, doesn't it? But according to Feeding America, there are nearly 500,000 people in Cook County who are food insecure, and it isn't always about access to food. It could be about access to the right kind of food. And let's go to Sullivan High School in Rogers Park for more about that.
We're a school where we speak over 40 different languages.
That is Joshua Cepeda, refugee social worker for Chicago Public Schools.
And we have a huge population of Muslim students and almost no halal options.
And for Muslims, all food must be halal, meaning sourced and prepared under Islamic rules. And the food offerings at CPS are not in tune with halal, leaving a lot of students food insecure during school hours.
83% of our students felt hungry and felt that there were no suitable halal options.
And how does that play out on a day-to-day basis?
Kids are going hungry. They're waiting till they can get home to eat. They're missing out on after-school activities. They're not able to access tutoring after school because they're hungry and they want to go home and eat. How do you play soccer on an empty stomach? And we have so many students that want to do these things, but maybe don't have the opportunity to do them because they're hungry throughout the day, because they don't have suitable halal options.
So students at Sullivan High School are taking their case to Aramark, the provider of lunches at Sullivan.
And demanding that they provide them with suitable options.
So food insecurity doesn't look the same to all of us, does it? Josh Cepeda's comments came last week at a community meeting during UNICEF's Global Forum for Children and Youth, and it was sponsored by the Islamic Food and Nutrition Council of America, which is headquartered in Des Plaines. At the Chicago Board of Trade, beans were down 20 cents yesterday. They're up 14 right now. Corn is up a nickel. Wheat is down too. From the farm to your belly, today is National Bouillabaisse Day. Oh, I love that fish stew. And the first time I had it, it was in Chicago with Lyle Dean. And he bought. That's the business of food on 720. He almost always bought.
Hold on, I'm writing this down. Oh, that was not uncommon, huh?
No.
He's a good man.
He is. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
A little while ago, Philip Weiss was on with us talking about people getting laid off or fired. Amy Guth joins us to start about people getting hired. What's your first story today, Amy?
Yeah, that's right. So not too long ago, Cranes reported that Deere is moving their headquarters to Fulton Market, as are many companies. But part of that, they've announced plans that they're going to hire 300 technology workers right away. It'll be 150 within the next 2 years, with that goal being to double that number in 3 to 5 years. So that's a lot of tech jobs coming to that area. Part of that, they will get almost $5 million in tax credits over 10 years if they do hit those hiring goals, according to the State Department of Commerce and Economic Security. So another big tech presence happening right there in Fulton Market.
I'm just reading here. Ag is getting more attention. That's good to hear. Lord knows we have not only an agricultural-based economy in Illinois, but some companies like Caterpillar, which is marginally in the farm business, but also Deere and Company and so on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And their equipment, we know, we think of a tractor as being such a manual piece of equipment, but in fact, it's really become a lot more sophisticated in recent years. They have a lot of autonomous capabilities, the ability to generate real-time data for farmers and construction companies, things like that. So having tech workers there makes a lot of sense. They're also really doubling down on tech initiatives inside the company, more internal data of how they can manage supply chains and things like that.
You know, I should probably back off the Caterpillar thing because, well, I'm familiar with that company a little bit. And a long time ago, they developed a farm tread tractor that did not go so well called, I think it was the Challenger. I think we all know what Caterpillar does with big pieces of machinery, and that requires great engineering as well. But in this case, it's not Caterpillar, it's Deere. Talk to me about United Airlines now. What's the news on their front?
Yeah, so United said they have plans to purchase up to 100 hydrogen electric engines. United CEO Scott Kirby said that these are, he called it one of the most promising paths to zero emissions air travel for smaller aircraft. You know, while there is some excitement and certainly a great deal of interest around getting air travel to have just a little bit smaller carbon footprint, because it is such a big contributor, some in the industry are really a little skeptical about, will this technology be enough to completely replace the kind of jet engines that are in place right now? That if you think of the volume of all the planes in the sky, all the power they need to fly all over the place, will these engines be able to do it? And so that's really kind of the question there. But nonetheless, United is, they've reportedly they're going to purchase up to 100 of this engine from Zero Avia. They've described it as the zero emission, 100% hydrogen electric engine. They do expect them to use them in pairs on existing regional aircraft. There's been some testing around this. There was a test that was, I think, only about 15 or 20 minutes in the UK. And, you know, it was a successful test. So I think we'll start seeing more of this, but that's a big commitment. And I think when you see a big commitment from a major carrier for new kinds of technology, you also, it kind of legitimizes it and elevates it in a way. And not too long ago, just a couple of weeks ago, United flew a flight from here to the East Coast using sustainable aviation fuel to try to get attention from lawmakers to try to subsidize more of that, saying it works great. It works just like traditional jet fuel, but it's so very expensive. It's very hard to use it now. It's very hard to buy it.
One more story. Locally, Walgreens is in the news. What's the story there?
Yeah, so Walgreens has said now that if you are a Chime banking customer, that you can now deposit cash at a Walgreens location. They had an interesting data point. They said they believe that about 78% of the U.S. population lives near a Walgreens location. So they're trying to make banking very convenient. Interestingly, that's at a time in which a lot of banks are scaling back their physical locations, because they're saying, hey, more of our customers want to use more digital means. Chime is a fairly technology-focused operation for banking. But what's interesting about this story to me is that now Walgreens is in the same space with some other retailers moving into that financial technology space. You know, Walmart did this. They're trying to provide customers with some financial services. Mm-hmm. Amazon and Apple, they have payment options, things like that. So it's kind of these, a lot of reporting around this story has been describing it as non-bank operations that do bank things, you know. So I think this non-bank term will be something we see applied to more retailers.
Yeah, the line's really been blurred these days. That's Amy Guth joining us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.